Rick James was one of the most prolific and controversial musicians of the 70s and 80s, and his life was just as fascinating as his love ballads and party jams. In Super Freak, The Life of Rick James, Peter Benjaminson gives us an inside look at the singer-songwriter's life and music, from his humble beginnings in Buffalo, New York, to his big break with Motown, and the drug addiction and jail time that affected him later in his life. It's published by Chicago Review Press, and I'm very pleased it has brought Peter Benjaminson to our show now. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate being here.
There have been two books already written about Rick James, ostensibly by him, right? A memoir and an autobiography, Glow, the autobiography of Rick James, and The Confession of Rick James, Memoirs of a Super Freak, both published posthumously.
Well, ostensibly is the right word. They were both published posthumously. Rick apparently or may have recorded his life story while he was in prison. Somebody bootlegged the transcript and used it to write the book. Most of the names are misspelled. Then, like Berry Gordy is misspelled, so it obviously wasn't someone familiar with the music business. Then David Ritz, one of my colleagues and competitors, rewrote it and added some stuff and made it Glow. That is, he made the title Glow. But it still wasn't a biography. It was an autobiography, which is why I wanted to write mine.
Because autobiographies are notoriously inaccurate at times.
You've got that right.
How, you had to research what was right and what was incorrect in the man telling his own story?
Yes. In fact, I had to put in a lot that Rick didn't want revealed. I got a lot of it from his relatives, from his ex-wives, his widow, I should say, and other people, which filled out the story and made it a slightly, or I should say a largely different story.
Didn't he have some well-known relatives, news anchors, politicians, James Brown?
Yes, James Brown was his cousin. They were related through his mother, who was also an entertainer. Right now, Laurie Stokes, who's a big-time broadcaster here in New York City, is his cousin. Chuck Stokes, who's a major Detroit broadcaster, is his cousin. Louis Stokes, who was chairman of the House Assassinations Committee, and Chuck's and the other Stokes, I just forgot his name, I'm blanking on it, but he was the mayor of Cleveland, the first black mayor of an American city, a major American city.
Carl.
They're all his cousins. Carl, thank you. We're all his cousins. So
he
he's from a prominent
guest on our
family.
Show. That's why I remember.
Great. Very good.
So what was Rick's upbringing in Buffalo in the 50s like?
It was rough.
Even though his mother was an entertainer?
His mother was an entertainer until she gave birth to Rick and his brother Leroy, who, by the way, is now a prominent attorney and painter in Buffalo. She worked in the numbers racket, which was just the illegal equivalent of what's now legal, the state lottery. And so she was able to support the family fairly well.
He didn't have a relationship with his father?
No, the father left early on, and they never reconciled.
Father showed up when he was famous, I imagine. This often happens.
Well, no, the father got married to someone else, stayed married to that woman, stayed away from Rick until just before he, the father, died. And then he tried to reconcile, but Rick wouldn't have any of it.
How old was Rick when he started performing?
Oh, it was probably 9 or 10. He was very precocious in every aspect of life.
And what kind of music?
He imitated the songs that were prevalent at the time and did doo-wop on the corner with a group he called the Duprés in Buffalo. That certainly wasn't his most original contribution to music, and that was his big thing. He was a very original contributor to all sorts of musical styles.
Probably the most sampled musician of his time.
Exactly.
When you think of, we'll get to that later, this his very famous riff from Super Freak. Why did he enlist in the U.S. Navy Reserve?
I think it was one of his worst decisions. He was very young. In fact, that was the problem. He was too young to enlist in the Navy legally. So his mother forged the papers indicating that he was legal and then approved his illegal entry. someone advised him that to avoid actual hard dog military service, he could get by with just going to drills on weekends. But he didn't want to go to drills on weekends and started skipping them.
Was he performing music at the time?
Only on the street corners. And
still?
Yes, right.
Then he deserted the Navy and moved to Toronto.
Yes. Well, that was both good and bad. The desertion made him a fleeing federal felon for years. But the move to Toronto was inspired. That's where he started his real musical career, forming groups and performing and recording a lot of records.
He met Neil Young. Was that around that time, or did that come up later?
No, that was it. Well, Rick spent 14 years in Toronto trying to get into the big time, met Neil Young, lots of other famous musicians there, and played with them.
While he was in the Navy, Rick was court-martialed twice.
Yes.
For desertion?
Yes, exactly. And then for breaking out of jail, breaking out of the brig after he was sentenced the first time. He didn't like the Navy. He didn't like being in Navy prison. I wouldn't have either.
But he had to have come back to the U.S. to have been caught. He had gone to Motown hoping to record?
Yes, he went. Well, it was easy to go back and forth across the Canadian-U.S. border then. No one asked for passports. You give a fake name. No one cares. So while he was in Toronto, he tried three times to make it big at Motown, was unable to push through the bureaucracy there and of course, compete with the other very talented superstars. So he didn't really make it at Motown until his fourth attempt, which was after he'd served time and had been dishonorably discharged from the Navy.
How much time did he serve?
He had a criminal past. In Toronto, he served maybe a couple of years for various clothing store robberies and other robberies, in which I believe he was trying to get the money to do recording. Then he did 6 months in the brig for desertion, and then they dishonorably discharged him. But this didn't stop him. He was a very strong achiever, like the rest of his family. He wanted to get to the top and would do almost anything to achieve that.
How did he meet Neil Young? They strike me as a rather unlikely pair.
Not really. There were a lot of people in Toronto. There were 1,400 groups at one point performing just in Yorkville, a Toronto neighborhood. So there were thousands, literally, of rock stars and folkies trying to sing R&B, folk music, rock. They met on the street. Rick saw Neil carrying a guitar. They started talking about the guitar, and they went on from there. Then they became members of the Minor Birds, a band that was sponsored by a guy who loved minor birds and insisted they sing only about minor birds. It wasn't very successful.
Was that an R&B band?
No, it was a sort of a rock band. Colin Kerr, he was a Toronto entrepreneur. He paid them to sing about minor birds, which he was fixated on. He later opened a club called the Minor Bird Club, which featured minor birds. Rick finally couldn't take it anymore. Neither could the other minor birds. He wanted them to dress up as minor birds and cut their hair in a minor bird style, which involved V's on each side of their head. They revolted and left. They went on to play other music, but not minor bird music.
Did he and Neil Young ever collaborate again?
No, because that's just before Rick decided that he had to turn himself in to serve his federal prison time for deserting the Navy. Neil got disgusted, drove to Los Angeles, founded all the groups that he's been involved in, and from that time he never looked back. Although they
Crosby,
were still
Still,
friendly.
Yes. Et cetera.
Right.
So Rick kept on going to Detroit to try to sign with Motown, which was then a really hot label. He met Marvin Gaye and Stevie Wonder there?
Yes, and all the others. He and his band members would sit in a room writing songs. Whenever they'd run into a musical problem, Marvin Gaye or Smokey Robinson, one of the others, would come in, and in the words of one of the guys who was there, they'd Motown them. They'd tell them what to do.
I'm speaking with Peter Benjaminson, his book, Super Freak, The Life of Rick James. But why did it take so long for Motown to sign him to a record deal? He may have been troubled, but he obviously had a lot of musical ability.
He was at one point, in fact, they did sign him to a record deal, or they were about to, but then he got into a fight with the manager of the group, who revealed to Motown that he was, in fact, a fleeing federal felon. Motown was sensitive about confronting the government during the Paola era or any of the years thereafter, didn't want to employ a felon as one of their musicians, so they let him go.
Who's Tony Nolasco?
Tony was the guy who actually made Rick a success. He helped Rick record his first record album, Come Get It, which Motown eventually bought and which sold millions of copies, making Rick a star.
He formed a group called the Stone City Band. And some of the musicians in it stayed with him for a while, didn't they? The Danny Lamell, who is the sax player at the end of Super Freak, was in that band.
Yes, the Stone City Band members were very loyal to him. Rick treated them well. He allowed them to perform in the studio and on the road, which is great for musical purity.
Now, Motown, which, as we said earlier, was one of the most powerful labels in America for a while, it went into decline. All of their stars either were leaving or aging out. So is Rick James credited with helping save it?
He was. He continued its life for several years, in my opinion. He was the penultimate Motown superstar, the next to the last. The last one was actually Lionel Richie, who was much different than Rick. But Rick kept it going for a few extra years to his great credit.
With punk funk.
Yes, that's right. What Rick did actually was combine realistic lyrics with disco music. That was his first trick.
And that's what we heard in the opening song.
Yes, that's right. Later, he dropped the disco part and moved into kind of an early precursor of rap. So he carried music all the way from disco with no sensible lyrics to realistic lyrics onto rap, which has very little music but realistic lyrics.
Was he already heavily into drugs?
He started. He smoked marijuana when he was a kid. I'm not sure if you should call that heavily into drugs or not, since most musicians do that. It got worse and worse as he went on. He moved up from a minor drug to a major drug, and finally was freaked out continuously on crack, which really did him in.
Well, to some degree, that he was turned onto that by Sly. Sylvester Sly of the Family Stone.
Yes, exactly. What's funny about that, though, was he confronted Sly about that, told Sly that he was ruining himself. He was missing 25 concerts a year because he was sucking on the pipe, and Rick said he'd never do that. Then he started doing it. The appeal of drugs is overwhelming.
He also did some producing. He discovered Tina Marie.
Yes, he discovered a lot of acts, Tina Marie, the Mary Jane Girls, various others. He was a great producer, and that's what made him even more valuable to Motown.
The Mary Jane Girls were kind of a transitional group?
Well, they led the way for girl groups like the Spice Girls and numerous others. They were much different than Motown's early groups in that they were allowed to move on stage and be sexy, unlike the Supremes.
How did the rivalry between Prince and Rick James get started?
Well, Prince started imitating Rick and then started to do his own stuff, and then Rick would imitate Prince. So they went back and forth, each one, as they say, biting off the other, imitating them without permission.
This was not a friendly rivalry.
No, they disliked each other. They liked each other at first, but later on they were in desperate competition.
Then his best-selling album was Street Songs. How did that come about, and how did he wind up creating Super Freak, which turned out to be one of the biggest hits of its time?
Well, Rick started at Motown with Come Get It, and that sold very well. Then his record sales started to decline. Finally, he was hitting a low point, decided to leave Los Angeles, where he was and Motown was, go back to Buffalo, and mix in with his old pals in the ghetto, get realistic lyrics. That's what made Street Songs a big album. It talked about prostitution, pimps, etc. Super Freak, though, was an English type song that Rick's brother, Leroy Johnson, suggested that he include. Rick poo-pooed it. He said it sounded too English, too white a song.
So he didn't write it?
No, one of his pals, Alonzo Miller, wrote it. But Alonzo was influenced by the Englishman. It was really an English song. So Leroy was finally able to get Rick to put it on the record and on the album, and it was a gigantic hit. It's a beautiful song. I love it. And it came to encapsulate Rick's personality, although he didn't write it about himself. He wrote it about women he liked who were super freaky and did anything he wanted.
Did they have to tone down the lyrics when they recorded it?
Yes. Well, there was one line where he says, this girl will do anything you want once you get her in the sheets. In those days, that was considered obscene, so they had to say, when you get her off the street. You know, lyrics have progressed or degressed beyond that, but at the time, that would have been controversial.
Didn't he work with Stevie Wonder on Mr. Policeman, one of his other records?
Yes, he worked with Stevie Wonder a lot. Wonder loved him, really. At one point, Rick was on stage with a woman who had a huge hat. Stevie was in the audience. Rick yelled at Stevie that he ought to take a look at this hat, which could be considered a diss because Wonder's blind. Mm-hmm. But Wonder laughed hysterically. Wonder always was open, in spite of being blind from age 5 on, was open to jokes about his being blind and loved them.
He was at the height of his success around the time MTV was taking off. Why did he have a rough time getting his video shown there?
Well, the only thing I can say in all honesty is that MTV was racist. They didn't want to put black people on TV. You know, radio and TV are different. On radio, you don't see whether the people are black or not. And a lot of people sounded black but were white. That was the problem.
I worked for a record company, and we had a record that we wanted to advertise on MTV, a black artist, a very famous one at the time, and they wouldn't take it. But then Michael Jackson changed all of that. They just couldn't ignore his success. And so MTV, after a while, became a vehicle for a lot of African-American artists.
For a while, but then it segregated them again. It founded VH1 and a couple of other stations so that it could push the black entertainers onto other stations. It was, Michael Jackson helped. That was corporate, too. I've forgotten the corporations involved, but MTV was threatened with corporate sanctions unless it ran Jackson's song.
Why did Motown sue Rick in 1986?
He was getting too aggressive and overwhelming in terms of his relations with the other people there, and his record sales were declining. You know, as his record sales declined and he got more and more obnoxious, they just wanted to get rid of him.
And how was it resolved?
Oh, they did get rid of him. He counterclaimed that they owed him several $1 million worth of royalties, and in fact, they paid him $2 million. So it was settled to both sides' satisfaction.
And then MC Hammer acquired the rights for Super Freak to create You Can't Touch This. Did that mean that Rick James was once again popular?
Absolutely. It rescued him. He did a couple of albums after Motown, and they didn't sell well, but Hammer revived his career by using the bass line of Super Freak in You Can't Touch This and making him a star again.
Who are Frances Alley and Mary Sauger?
They were two women who claimed that Rick sexually and otherwise assaulted them in Los Angeles later in his life.
So he was put on trial?
Yes, he was on trial in a true Super Freak manner. He allegedly assaulted Sauger while he was out on bail for allegedly assaulting Alley. This was, I think, the work of drugs. He was not convicted of anything with Alley. He was found not guilty of anything with Alley except supplying her with cocaine, which is like a joke verdict at that time. Sauger was more serious. Sauger allegedly assaulted Rick's wife, Tanya, and Rick punched her, causing her injuries. And he was convicted of that and served a couple of years in Folsom.
And was he treated like a star when he was in jail?
By some of the people there, yes. He claimed the correction officers were out to get him because he was such a big deal. But he was protected by his fellow inmates.
He made an appearance on the Chappelle show.
Yes, he did, which was amazing because the Chappelle parodies of him showed him as an out-of-control freak, which you wouldn't, no one you'd like to meet, but he loved it. It revived his popularity.
How old was he when he died?
56.
Was there an autopsy?
Yes, there was. It showed that he had drugs in his system, but none of the drugs, there were seven or eight of them, none of them, there wasn't enough of them to hurt or really kill him. He was had become a low-level drug user, which was actually one of his goals. One of the things his mother, who loved him, wanted him to do was stop taking drugs. And he had certainly throttled down on the drugs, which would have been of great comfort to her.
Do you think that in the end he'll be remembered more for his music or for all of his problems?
That's a good question. I'd say both. He was so spectacular in all areas of life, with problems and with music, that he'll be remembered for both. But the music is very good. His problems are common, but the music was extraordinary, and that's why he should be remembered.
You've written a number of books that relate to the Motown story. Are you finished with it?
Maybe, although I'm trying to get a contract for a book on Holland Dozier Holland. No one's ever written a book, and they've interacted.
They wrote so many hit songs.
Yeah, they've interacted with every Motown star, sometimes good and sometimes bad. That'll be a great book.
Peter Benjaminson, his latest book is Super Freak, The Life of Rick James. It is published by, who's publishing this?
Chicago Review Press.
Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.